Good afternoon, everyone. SolarCloud, right now we'll have the talk by Anshul Gupta, SolarCloud Cluster Management APIs. He's working for IBM Watson and is an Apache Lucene Solar member and committer. Basically, if you have any question at the end, please wait until I grab the mic so that everything gets properly recorded. Thank you.
Okay. I'll just come over to the side. Hi, guys. A bit about myself. I'm Anshul Gupta, Lucene Solar Committer, PMC member, work for IBM, Watson, part of the search team there. And yes, I've been involved with the project for a reasonably long time now. So let's talk a little more about solar and companies that use them. So you've got Bloomberg, Watson, Box, Etsy. Looking at the numbers there, it's a pretty active project. People at Bloomberg use it at extremely high throughput requirements. Watson uses it for complicated use cases. Instagram, Etsy, different use cases. Some of them deal with a ton of data. Others deal with a lot of traffic. There are a lot of companies who deal with both when it comes to solar Lucene. And if you guys did not know about it, Lucene was also the parent project of Hadoop. So that's where Hadoop and Notch and everything, a bunch of other projects actually came out of. A little bit about the project activity. It's a pretty active project considering it's been about 10 years old. It's been up there in terms of activity. It's never really dropped off. Number of contributors has been going up. The number of commits has been going up. The commits there, I see a lot of people ask me that question about, oh, it doesn't compare to another project, X, which is on GitHub. You guys don't commit as often. That's probably because we come from the SVN family of projects, and the way we generally did things was one ticket, one issue, and one commit, which basically meant there weren't 20 commits for a single feature to be added to Solar. So a little bit of history here about Solar Cloud. Solar Cloud was introduced in Solar 4.0, and back then the intention was to just get it out of the box, get it up and running, a distributed framework for Solar for things to happen automatically. There were no APIs for you to do things. It was just built up and released in a manner that you could still have this up and running, but there were no fancy nice APIs to do things. And like every other project, we've come a long way ever since. Looking at the basic architecture of Solar Cloud, this is how it generally looks like, right? Physical architecture. If I were to have a logical representation, that would probably be way more simpler to understand, way less lines in there. But that's how the physical architecture looks like. We've got Zookeeper for not just configuration management, which is what most people use it for. It's also used for message passing across nodes, just as a means for persisting these messages. So you've got nodes with cores or replicas in both those nodes. For the sake of simplicity, I've just shown two nodes in there, but regular production system would generally have tons, way more than that. And then you've got clients, talk to a load balancer, which talks to your solar cluster. You've got a lot of interaction going on between both of these nodes, and you've got interaction going on between the nodes themselves and Zookeeper. So starting up, until before 5.0 came out, starting up Solar was complicated. You had to start it up, you had to bootstrap it. There was no way to run a Solar instance without a core in there. So for a new user to come up and start up Solar Cloud meant you had to start Zookeeper. You had to bootstrap it with some sample configuration, and you had to start up a Solar instance which would come up with a magical collection, one collection. That is what it was called. And you would just have that collection stay there until you explicitly deleted it and added something else that made more sense to you in terms of what you wanted to name your collection. So, over the last couple of years, year and a half, we've had a lot of APIs that have come in, starting from creating, for the purpose of creating a collection, to starting up Solar and adding a config set, managing a config set. there's an API now for pretty much everything you can think of. Now, while there are APIs to create a collection, the next obvious step for anyone is to scale up, right? Which basically translates to wanting to add a replica for an existing slice or for an existing replica that you have in your Solar Cloud cluster. Well, there's been an API call for that for a long time now called Add Replica. But again, about a year ago, we added the replica placement strategy in Solar, wherein you could specify a bunch of rules which kick in every time you make any changes to your cluster, which is through API calls or something going down, a split shard or something. And these rules kick in for the purpose of deciding where a new replica should be placed. Well, before this, it was random selection, so one of your nodes could end up having a ton of your leaders, for instance. Not anymore. You can specify rules like, I want to have a new replica for this collection to be placed only on disks that have X gigs of free storage. Or I want to have all replicas for this one collection to be on this rack. So we've got rack awareness, machine awareness, and DC aware placement strategies that are shipped out of the box with Solar now. It's easy to extend, so you can have your own metrics and you can have your own systems, snitches in terms of rules, to decide or help Solar decide where should new replicas go. And all of these rules are used for any calls that involve any new addition of a replica. So while that's one way to go ahead and add a replica in terms of increasing traffic, there are times when your traffic's not really going up, but your data is now increasing. What you really want to do at that point is go ahead and either split that data into two sub-pieces in terms of shards. So you have one big shard that's grown way bigger than you want it to be, and you can fire a split shard API, which was introduced in 5.3, and what it lets you do is split a shard into two pieces based on either an explicitly passed in split point or just at the middle of the hash range that shard owns. Now, because the assumption is that your data is evenly distributed, not providing with a split point generally works in most cases, unless you have your own routing mechanism going on, in which case it's good to define the split point for you. Right now, Solar does not have a way to figure out what that good split point should be if it's not right in the middle, and so it's for the user to figure out what's a good split point. Now, when you split a shard, it basically still belongs to the same collection. The parent shard's then marked as inactive. Once the process completes successfully, the new subshards are activated, and the replication factor that was for the parent is now achieved for the subshards as well. That is all automated. That's all real-time with no downtime at all, which I think is pretty cool. But like all systems distributed, it comes with its own issues. I would really recommend that you do not use this command, especially when you're having like peaks or surges in traffic or ingestion. If that's the case, wait out until the rate at which you're hitting Solar has gone down. Now, there are times when you really want to just migrate this data off of one collection into another collection instead of splitting this shard out, because you're like, you had some routing mechanism and data for a particular customer resided on a particular shard, and you figured that this customer has way more data than everyone else, so it probably makes most sense to give this person their own collection. So that's where the migrate API call comes in, and you can use the migrate API call to specify, this is the hash range I want to migrate from my original source collection and into a new target collection. So that's really good when you really want to migrate this data completely to a different collection. The prerequisite for this is that you have to explicitly create the collection. Solar's not going to do that for you. Now, while we learned about having APIs for creating a collection, adding a replica, having replica placement strategies, being able to split a shard, migrate the data from one collection to the other, you generally want to have a ton of other status APIs to get an idea of what's going on. How does your collection look like? How does your cluster look like? And for that, there are APIs like List, which basically gets you a list of all active collections in Solr. Overseer status. So the Overseer in Solr Cloud terminology is the node that's responsible for writes to Zookeeper pretty much, updating your cluster states, and delegating and completing collection-related tasks. So be it adding a new collection, adding a new replica, deleting a collection, all of these are taken care of by the Overseer node. The Overseer node could be co-located or not be co-located, could be one of the existing nodes that also serve as a regular data node. So you've got Overseer status. The response for that is basically, for that call is, what are the requests that have been coming in? What are the percentiles for each of these requests? So let's say a create collection call. What's the 75th percentile for this request? How many errors have you seen for a create collection request failure? Stuff like that. You get all of that information from the Overseer status call. Then you've got cluster status call, which basically gives you a snapshot of your entire cluster status in terms of what are the collections, what are the replicas for the shards, what are the active nodes that host replicas. And the last one is the core admin status, which basically gives you an insight into the core or the replica itself. It's a very detailed and low-level API call is what I'd say, because it's not a Solr Cloud-specific call. It's more like a Solr-specific call. And why I'm highlighting these calls here is until not so long back ago, there were no such calls. So if you wanted to get a list of all collections in your Solr instance, and if you're on an older Solr Cloud version, you probably don't have these calls right now. So if you wanted to get a list of all the collections that exist in your Solr Cloud cluster, that meant having to access Zookeeper, get back your cluster status from Zookeeper, look at your collections that exist in Zookeeper, and then parse it and get that list. Not anymore. You've got all of these nice commands that basically fetch the same information from Zookeeper and provide that to the end user. So all shards in Solr for every collection have a leader, right? The job of the leader is basically to version every incoming document to maintain optimistic concurrency and make sure that the versions of every document that's coming in is maintained correctly. You're not overwriting an older version, a newer version with an older version. That's the only extra job of a leader, but that's a pretty critical job. Now, there are times when you want to elect a leader. A lot of times, all of this happens by itself, but there are times when you want to force a leader election. When you have a legit leader, but you just want to move it to something else. And if you look at these calls, here are some calls that come in handy when you really want to do that. The first one is to add and remove a role. Right now, the only supported role is that of the overseer. So you can specify that a particular node is what you really want to assume the role of the overseer if such a role is present. Now, this is just a preferred role. If there is no assigned node that has this role, then it doesn't really matter, and Solr is just going to elect a regular overseer the way it generally does. But you can explicitly define a node to be the overseer, especially if you know that you have a ton of collection API calls coming in and you don't want your data nodes to be the same nodes that handle these operations as well. They're not heavy operations, but there are still use cases where I've seen it makes sense to have an isolated or independent overseer node. The second one is add or delete replica prop, which is also an API call. What it lets you do is it lets you set a preferred leader. So for a shard, you can set a preferred leader to a particular replica to be a preferred leader. Why you would want to do that is if you want to evenly spread out your leaders, you want to explicitly say, for this shard, I want this guy to be the leader because I know this is the best suited node for this. For this other shard, this is the guy I really want to assume leadership. And again, this is a preferred thing. If you don't set it, doesn't really matter. It just randomly assigns a leader. The problem there, though, could be that you could have a single node that hosts all your leaders. That node going down would trigger a bunch of leader elections, automatic leader elections, and you generally don't want that to happen. And that's the reason why you want to set a preferred leader. Just remember, setting a preferred leader does not mean that an election kicks in. The election is not triggered by setting off the preferred leader. It is only used when, for some reason, election is triggered. That's when such a property is read and used. It does not trigger anything. Balance shard unique. It's a rather unintuitive name for an API call, but that's an API call that lets you evenly distribute a property across your shards for a collection. As complicated as it may sound, to give you an example, say you've got a collection with 5 shards, each of them having 3 replicas each. Now you want to have preferred leader distributed in a manner that they're spread out as widely as possible on your Solar Cloud cluster without you having to manually decide, okay, this shard should have this guy as the leader, and because I've already selected this node, I want the other shard's leader to be on a different node. You don't want to manually do that. So if you execute this call, it's going to auto-assign preferred leader roles to all shards in a collection and try to distribute it as much as it can. Remember there, though, that it would not really set a preferred leader for a shard that you've explicitly already set preferred leader for. So if you've already pre-decided what your preferred leader should look like or where it should be, and you invoke this call, it would not touch anything that you've explicitly set. Then you've got rebalance leaders, which actually triggers the leader election. And as soon as you do that, it goes ahead and consumes your preferred leader property and sets the leaders as you would generally want them. The last one is force leader, rather tricky call. Do not use it unless you really know what you're doing. It is generally used when, in an event when one of your shards does not have any active leaders. Well, that stuff happens. It could be a part of your migration process or things just going down, and you're left with a shard with a ton of replicas, but none of them have been elected leaders, and you'll see stuff get logged into Solr saying, I expect this guy to be the leader, but I don't see this guy to be the leader. You'll see such sort of stuff in your logs. You could use force leader and explicitly specify that I want this guy to be the leader, in which case Solr is going to force election and force this one replica to assume leadership. The reason why I say be careful with firing that thing off is if you add a replica that does not contain any data and you force a force leader on that replica without any documents, it's going to just assume that you know what you're doing and resume leadership. And it's going to go out and tell every other replica that there is for that shard that, hey, I'm the leader and I have no documents. You're not supposed to have anything. So it's going to wipe off everything that exists. So if you only use that if you know what you're doing. So we've seen there are a bunch of interesting API calls that certainly make things easy. For example, lists or the cluster status or the overseer status API call. The problem here is none of these tend to practically accomplish everything that you would want to get done with just a single call, right? So let's look at a few examples here. The first one is shard splitting. Well, yes, there's a shard splitting API. Which you could fire and say, here's this replica for this collection, I want you to split the shard and it's all magic. But there's a bunch of stuff that Solr does not look at before it actually starts working on a shard splitting call. An example of that is, it would not look at, do I have enough disk space to actually execute this call? And as dumb as it may sound, and you would want this to work automatically, the intention of introducing those calls was for people to use these calls themselves, knowing how their disk structure, network topology, and stuff like that looks like, and for Solr not to do things automatically. And that's been true historically for Solr, where we've tried to move away from things happening automatically, be it auto recovery of all things going down, all replicas for a shard going down. We don't automatically add things up. We don't automatically turn on the switch for something. We just wait for the user to do stuff. So how do you ideally want to process a shard split, right? The first thing you want to do is run cluster status. Look at your cluster status. See that you have at least one active. The leader is active and good and healthy before you fire off your shard split. Because if your leader is not healthy, your shard split is based off of your leader, and it's not going to work fine. You run cluster status, you run core status. Core status gets you information about your disk usage and stuff. What that gives you is you know how much disk you want to use. What a split chart call does is it replicates all of that data into a new index directory. So your data is basically getting duplicated at that point in time. You want twice the index size to be available on that disk before you fire off this call. So you have to make sure that there's enough disk space. And once you're done with that, what split chart does is you've got a parent chart that you want to split. The leader basically creates two subshards. Both of them contain half the data each in an ideal situation. And once that happens, it starts replicating. So it's buffering all of these documents in the meanwhile, all of the data that's coming in. And once all of that is done, it goes ahead and starts replicating to meet the replication factor of the original parent shard. And once that's done, it marks the parent shard to be inactive, marks the subshards to be active. Now the problem here is your parent shard, say, was the leader was a node one. The subshards would be, let's say, subshard 1_1, 1_0, and 1_1. Both of these leaders would now be on the same node that hosted the original leader. You really don't want that. You want to split out evenly. You want to split out your leaders evenly across your cluster. For that, you need to explicitly add a replica and then kill one of your subshards, newly created subshard leaders, and that's how. That's what would trigger a leader election and for a new sub-leader to have a new leader. So you need to do all of that. What split shard also does not do is clean up its original parent shard indexes. So it's marked everything is inactive. It's not going to serve any requests. It's not going to accept any updates. But there's unused disk space. There's disk space that's been wasted. That's a hole. And what you really want to do is you need to explicitly delete the old inactive shard. Unless you do so, let's say you had a 500 gig disk index, it's going to lie there, unused, unusable, eating up your disk space. And I'm assuming your original reason of splitting your shard was to, you know, use less disk on this one node. Now you're already using more disk than you were using. And it's not even being consumed properly. So those are the steps that you really want to follow for executing a proper split shard in production environment. The second recipe that I'm going to talk about is high availability. So in terms of Solar Cloud, I really recommend, if you want high availability, a replication of factor of 3 is what I would really recommend, at least a replication factor of 3. Replication factor of 2 gets it too close for you to lose stuff. By the time you know that you should recover or add a replica, your cluster management system gets to figure out that, oh, now we have only one replica, we need to add a new replica so that we're back at a replication factor of 2, which does not happen in Solar automatically. You're already walking on that fine line, assuming that this only replica would not go down. 3, I've seen, has worked way better, especially if you can afford that and your data is so important, it makes sense for you to have a replication factor of 3. Now, before you do that, what you really want to do is check your cluster health. Why I say that's important is because of the way leader election works in Solar. As soon as you add a new replica in Solar, what it ends up doing is it's going to go in, wait for a leader to sync with. If it does not find a leader to sync with, I'm assuming that both your replicas at this point, your replication factor was 2, both your replicas went down, your cluster management system decided, oh, we've lost our replicas, we need to add a new replica. You add a new replica, the new replica would wait for only 3 minutes. It's going to wait for 3 minutes and finally go ahead and say, I've waited enough. I don't see an active replica leader, so I'm going to assume leadership, right? So it's going to assume leadership with no documents at all. The new replica comes back up. Now, there is a fine line there. If there is no update that goes in and this new replica comes back up, odds are high that you'll be still fine. But if you send in a single update and this new index contains that one document only, the old replica, when it comes back up, is going to be like, okay, I'm up, but the new leader says, all you should have is this one document. And this wipe, the old replica goes ahead, wipes off everything, only has one document. So you really don't want to be in that position. You really want to be in a position where you go ahead and make sure you have an active replica before, active, healthy replica before you execute an add replica. There's an open Jira on this. There were a lot of discussions about what should happen, but there was no consensus. So right now, it's the responsibility of the end user to make sure that the cluster status is healthy when you add replica. And once you do that, add replica is going to use a replica placement strategy and make sure that you remove replicas when there are too many, especially if you're using a shared file system. Solr provides auto addition of replica in case of shared file system. So if you're running things off of HDFS, if all your replicas go down and if your collection creation, while creating a collection, you specified auto addition of replica is true, it's going to go ahead and spin off a new replica with this shared index again. The only thing is, it's never going to remove anything. So in case you're migrating or restarting your cluster, make sure you turn this feature off for that bit. There's a way to do that. If you fail to do that, it's going to go back up and say, wait, I don't see a replica. I've lost all my replicas. I'm going to spin one up. By the time everything comes back up, you have three replicas now. And in an event of another restart, it's going to go back and add another one. So you're going to continuously add something without ever taking anything away. So make sure that if you have a process to add a replica, there's something that's overlooking things and saying, OK, we have way too many, and we need to lower this number. So the last recipe I'm going to talk about is migrating cluster infrastructure, which is pretty much something that almost everyone that I know has to do at some point in time. Again, cluster status. Every time you want to do anything that involves moving replicas around, adding a replica, cluster status is your best friend. You get the status of your cluster, look at the overseer, look at the leaders. Now, one thing that you have to make sure is you either move your overseer first or you move your overseer last. We ran into this issue when the previous company I used to work with, we ran some tests for thousands of collections and tried a rolling restart for an upgrade to simulate an upgrade if you had 1,000 collections. The problem there was, let's say you have 5 nodes. The first node is the overseer at time t0, and your rolling restart shuts down node 1. Well, okay, you have node 2 elected as the overseer, but your rolling restart process next restarts node 2. Well, okay, you trigger another overseer election, and then node 3 gets picked up, right? And before you know, you've caused election, the overseer election happened multiple times. Every time the overseer comes back up, it looks at whatever was pending in its queue. It could be collection creation, it could be a split shot, it could be whatever. If that task was not completed, it's going to restart processing it, right? So you don't want the overseer to be pulled down every time it comes back up. So make sure that you look at your overseer, log it in your system, and say, I'm not moving this until everything else is done, or move this first. And how do you move this first is by setting, so you bring up a new node, set up this node to be the overseer, set up the role, then kill your original overseer. The overseer election process is going to pick up the new node to be the overseer from your new infrastructure. And then you can kill all the nodes from your previous infrastructure, and it's all going to be fine. So just remember that. Use rebalance leaders, and once you're done with your cluster movement, you can use rebalance leaders. One more new API that's been introduced in, I think it was released last month, was replace node. The good part about this API is, as opposed to what you had to do until a month and a half ago, which was independently go ahead and fire an add or delete replica call for every replica on a particular node that you want to take down for things to be safe. You can now just say replace node. You can add a new node. When you add a new node, Solr doesn't really do anything. It just becomes a part of your cluster without doing anything else. Then you just fire this call saying replace node, old node with new node. And it's going to move all your replicas from your old node to the new node. And it's all going to be automated. So that's a pretty cool API call, I think. And if at the end of it, things look bad, and you're sure that your new replica has the data, but there's no active leader, use force a leader election. But again, do it only if you're sure that your data is on those leaders. So we saw, we started off with Solar Cloud. We had no collection API. There was no way to even create a collection using an API. It was out there, it was usable, but it was hard to use and it was ugly to look at. Then we had APIs, and now we have APIs, but we need recipes, so we need to know what APIs to call and in what sequence and what to look for when we're calling a particular API. Over the last couple of years, what most of us saw was a lot of companies were doing, were building their own cluster management systems. There was a presentation that Apple gave about their cluster management system called SolarLord. Bloomberg has one, Broombreach has one, FullStory has one. Everyone has something called SolarLord, SolarMonitor, Solar something. Everyone calls it something else, right? And all of them do the same thing, which is, hey, I lost my replica. I want a replication factor of X on this collection, on this shard. Spin up a new replica. Do these checks. Take this action, which was basically a rule-based system that got triggered on events and then followed recipes. And at a conference last month, we discussed this and like, there's just too many people trying to solve the same problem over and over again, talking about it. And then there are Jiras and people try to contribute this stuff but a lot of them are in, let's say, older version of Solar. So someone's on 4.7 contributes a patch that works with 4.7, doesn't work with 6.x. And you're like, it would take way longer to port this to work with 6.x. So it probably makes sense for us to just restart, but build a framework that allows for users to build something like this. So I think last week I created an umbrella Jira for this, Solar 9735, called umbrella Jira for cluster management. I've broken it down into three pieces. The first one is basic APIs, which is have APIs like commission a new node. Right now, you can add a new node. You can bring it up, point it to Zookeeper. It joins your Solar cluster, but it doesn't do anything. An API call where you could explicitly call an API and say, OK, commission this node. I've just added it. It looks it up and then starts creating replicas because replication factor for a few collections has not been achieved, let's say. Right? So just straightforward APIs that are not auto-triggered, but require the user to trigger these, but still having those APIs is the first building block. The second thing was we need metrics. Right now, Solar has metrics, a ton of them, but there's no aggregation of these metrics at the collection level or the slice level or the shard level, right? So if you were to have rules like, if my QPS for collection X goes above 10,000 QPS, right, for a period of 30 minutes or more, I want my replication factor to go up, right? So rules like these require collection level view of your metrics in terms of QPS, in terms of ingestion rate, and in terms of, so you need not only core specific statistics, but you need aggregation of these, and you need more metrics anyways. So the second part of it was to add more metrics and aggregation of these metrics at different levels for users to get a better view of what to do with their cluster. And the third one was use these metrics to automatic trigger these recipes and make all of this to be a framework that can be extended so you can add your own complicated recipe or you can add your own complicated metric that is a combination of tons of other metrics. And have all of this as an automated process so that people can just use Solar out of the box without having to build this entire cluster management framework outside of Solar and then having to maintain it and have the pain of upgrading it with every subsequent Solar release. So yeah, we've just started working on this. We guys have a ton of stuff that we worked on at IBM. I intend to contribute all of that back, but I'm sure there are other companies also who've done similar stuff, so be it use cases or be it just code or anything related to this stuff, if you guys can contribute, that'd be pretty awesome. So that's it from my end. Thank you so much. Any questions?
Any questions?
Yeah.
Probably slightly off topic, but can you go into the scale of Solr use at Watson, like index size, queries?
I wouldn't have any numbers on that. I can share numbers from other companies that I know about, though. For example, I know Bloomberg uses Solr at a really nice scale. They have, if I remember it right, they have an SLA promise of 400 milliseconds of turnaround time for a document to be visible in search results. They have about 15,000 data sources that push in data almost every second. And they have tons of users. So they have real-time search and tons of data sources aggregated in Solr at latency requirements that look like this. Yeah. I wouldn't have any numbers from Watson, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other question?
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Please, applause.
Yeah. Wow.